Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the award-winning guitarist and composer, William Anderson. He's been praised multiple times by reviewers in the New York Times, Washington Post, Classical Guitar, and Fanfare magazines, and was called the perfect pioneer by the late guitarist Lily Afshar. Please join us on a magical journey through the land of contemporary or modern classical music and the many people who populate it. Hey, before we begin, please hit that like, follow, and subscribe buttons down there and all of the other buttons that you see. Also, leave a comment. I'm still trying to convince that goofy algorithm that people are actually paying attention. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show the wonderful guitarist and composer, William Anderson. Hey, Bill, thank you so much for coming on.
It's my great pleasure, Roger.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, listen, I got a lot to get into with you today, a lot to talk about. You've been at this a minute or two. You're a guitar player and you're a composer. The music that you focused on, from what I've been able to tell, has been largely contemporary music. Is that correct? And so can you kind of, how'd you happen to get caught up? Sounds like a cult. how did you happen to get involved in contemporary classical music as opposed to the traditional Spanish repertoire?
Yes, I became engrossed and passionate about exploring it.
Uh-huh.
Because I had some mentors who, they nudged me, and I was happy to be nudged. David Starobin was maybe the most important one. He's interested in contemporary music. But also, in the 80s, I was at Tanglewood. And
well, you must have been young.
I was 19 the first time I played with the Fellows.
Wow.
People. I played a piece by Luca Francesconi, his piece for guitar, percussion, and string quartet. And Luca Francesconi went on to become a sort of a gatekeeper for the Venice Biennale and the music that they do there. And I really wish I could reach out to him again. And in fact, I can, and I should. I should find him and reconnect. But those experiences in the early 80s, I was 81 when I did that. I was 19. And then they kept calling me back. And the reason they were calling me back was because they had works by living composers that employed the guitar. And I was the person who they, you know, they I fell into it that first year when I was with the Boston University program. There was a guitar program with Ed Flower that year. And then they kept calling me back throughout the 80s. And it was always because of contemporary music. So if you're playing contemporary music and you're a guitarist or a mandolinist, you can sneak into all kinds of very exalted organizations and performing groups, like the New York Philharmonic, like Tanglewood, like the Greg Smith Singers. All of these are Metropolitan Opera Chamber Players, Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. These were all gigs that I've done because I became the go-to guy for contemporary music, guitar, and mandolin.
Uh-huh, so, okay.
Yeah, and then because I was running an ensemble, Cygnus, I became one of the people who's active in promoting the work of living composers. And then because I got to know certain people, I ended up running the Roger Shapiro Fund for New Music, which is now the chief mover and shaker behind the classical music programming at the Village Trip.
Oh.
Which was what I'm hoping to talk with you about today, because
yeah,
I
really want to get into that too. So, okay.
We have a big slate of composers. So because the hat that I'm wearing most prominently now is as the artistic director of the Roger Shapiro Fund for New Music and its production arm, Marcius Productions. And we are putting on a whole series of concerts every September with the Village Trip. And it's just been wonderful working with the founders, Liz Thompson and Cliff Pearson. Liz is writes books about the folk music scene. She's written a book about Joan Baez, and she edited a book about Bob Dylan, and she's now working on another book. Cliff Pearson is an architecture writer.
Oh.
And they're so wonderful and curious and interested in all kinds of music. And so they let me do this My wife and I, Joan Forsythe, we do this together. We put together this program of concerts, and they're not that meant to be scary contemporary music. It's really very diverse and very broad selection of music. In fact, one of the things I wanted to mention is that it's impossible for one person to, what I really hold deep in my heart is a very, I'm very opinionated and very narrow, but I don't want the programming to be that narrow. And so I'm a matchmaker. I find performers, groups, string quartets, duos, trios, and if they're passionate about something, then I support it. And this broadens our programming. So all of the collaborators this year bring wonderful music that a lot of people are going to really love. And so I'm proud of being able to assemble things that's very broad and very, I think will catch. There's something for everyone.
So when is this going to occur?
Okay, well, we start with a little preview, a pre-concert events on the weekend of September 12, 13, 14. That's the Guitar Fest. We have the Olsen Dakari Duo. Do you know them?
No, I do not.
Guitar and voice. And John Olsen was the president of the New York City Classical Guitar Society for a while, but I think he stepped down. So he's a very wonderful and powerful influence and positive influence in classical guitar scene in New York and in the US, I'd say. And he's doing, they have a premiere by Thomas Flippin, some Rilke settings. Other premieres by Robert Morris, an important composer. He's now in Rochester. He taught at Eastman. David Glazer, who's a Village composer. We try to focus on Greenwich Village figures. The festival is called The Village Trip, and it celebrates the cultural legacy of Greenwich Village. And at first, the founders were very much focused on the folk scene, and what I do has broadened that, but I like to try to intersect with it. So one of the concerts will have John Corigliano's Bob Dylan arrangements. Did you know that John Corigliano did Dylan arrangements?
I know who he is, but I don't know that particular set.
I don't either. I'm looking forward to hearing that. So I would I don't know how best to do this, but maybe we can talk about music a little bit and then talk of specific events that I'd like everyone to know about. But after that first pre-concert weekend of guitar music, we start on the 19th of September with James Martin, baritone, and Lynn Raley, pianist. And for that, the Village Trip commissioned the legendary David Amram. In case your audience doesn't know the name David Amram, he's mentioned in a Raffi song. He was Leonard Bernstein's composer in residence, first composer in residence. Yeah. And he wrote the music for, there are two films he did the music for them, and the music is just so exquisite, so gorgeous. Splendor in the Grass, I think, was the first. That's Elia Kazan. And it's a masterpiece of American. It's a drama. It's a tearjerker. It's a Splendor in the Grass. The music he does the music throughout, and it's just gorgeous. The other one is Manchurian Candidate. Yeah, Amran did the music to Manchurian Candidate, the first version, of course, with
Frank
Frank
Sinatra.
Sinatra. Frank Sinatra. And it was that's a Frankenheimer film. I think that the acting in that film is just flawless because of the way that I think Frankenheimer has a way of doing it, that there's just not a false move. And even Sinatra, who's not the greatest actor, he just comes across as really shining in that film. And the music is drop dead gorgeous, especially when these woodwinds come in. So if you don't like going to concerts, just listen to those movies and you get a little sampling of what David Amram does. Amram is the Village Trip's composer emeritus. And he's 95 years old. He's getting up there. And he just finished his last commission, which was our commission. He decided to do five songs. And I jotted down poets. These are poets that are connected to his beat friends, because
Oh, goes back to the beat area.
Amram was friends with the beat people, especially Jack Kerouac.
Okay.
And now, so he knew Neil Cassidy. He knew Jack Kerouac. He knew them all, but he especially hung out with those two. And so for this particular song cycle, he chose poems by Carolyn Cassidy, Leslie Marmon Silka, Ron Whitehead, Ted Jones, Tom Piazza. And those, Carolyn Cassidy, I think, is the wife of Neil Cassidy.
God, just about everybody but Ginsberg.
Exactly. So, and now I've had many wonderful conversations with David Amram, and I did ask him, do you think of yourself as a beat composer? And he said, no, I'm not a beat composer. He's just a composer. He's an amazing composer who is proud of his friendship and the time that he spent hanging out with Kerouac in Greenwich Village. He just loves that period of time. Amram has such an interest. He wrote lots of books, so I recommend all of the books he wrote. He talks about his time in Washington, D.C., where he had a basement apartment where he invited all the jazz greats, including Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, all of them. He just knew them all, and he jammed with them. He was a jazz French hornist, maybe the only
That's
one.
there's a niche if I ever heard of one.
There's a niche. And now he and I have a mutual friend in Gunther Schuller, because Gunther Schuller was a French horn player. And Gunther Schuller was at Tanglewood. He wrote a famous book about jazz. And Gunther Schuller was David Amram's French horn teacher at Manhattan School. Gunther died, of course, recently, Gunther Schuller. And he was the guy at Tanglewood who was and he was programming all the Paul Fromm contemporary music concerts at
Oh,
Tanglewood.
okay.
And I knew him through that. So David Amram, we could talk for the rest of the time about David Amram. I just love him to pieces, and he's a very important part of the Village Trip. There are other pieces on that, other interesting composers on that program. Carmen Moore, I'll mention. Carmen Moore is he lives in New York, but he spends a lot of time in Denmark, and he wrote a piece called A Village Triptych.
Oh.
And it's a joke on the name of the festival, Village Trip. A Village Triptych. Three village poets: Djuna Barnes, and I have a Djuna Barnes song cycle. I'll get to that later if we have time. But Djuna Barnes, Gamelle Woolsey, she lived on Patchen Place, just like Djuna Barnes,
Okay.
but in the 20s, so quite a bit earlier. When Barnes was in Paris, Gamelle Woolsey was living on Patchen Place in Greenwich Village. How well do you know the village?
I don't.
Okay, well, you should come sometime. It's worth exploring. It's a magical spot in the Northeast. The architecture is basically Civil War era,
Okay.
beautiful, simple brick buildings, but beautiful brick buildings. But it's also a kind of a mashup of more recent building in and around the cracks of the old stuff. So Carmen Moore, back to his song cycle, A Village Triptych. Djuna Barnes, Gamelle Woolsey, who's not so well known, but should be better known. And the third song in the cycle is by his friend Lennox Raphael, who wrote a very controversial play called Che. It was censored. People were arrested. There was nudity. There was obscenity. There was everything to offend the authorities. It was a success to scandal. And so I was really glad to be introduced to Lennox Raphael's poetry, and I got to know it before he died. He died just last year in Denmark.
Okay.
There seems to be a New York expat community in Denmark of
Okay.
composers and poets, which doesn't surprise me. But I say go to it. So if I can't find you in New York, I'll look for you in Denmark.
Yeah, I'll be in Rudersdal.
So I'll just mention a few more things then. How much time do we have?
Plenty. I own this thing. We can be here till supper time. No
Okay.
problem.
Just interrupt me if I drone on for too long. So,
Okay.
so I'll just mention it. There's a Bernstein weekend, and there are two events. One of them was organized by my wife, Joan Forsyth. She calls it Classical Cool, and it's for young people. It will be hosted by Nina Bernstein, the youngest Bernstein daughter. And it will conclude with Carnival of the Animals. There'll be some young players, a young pianist, and a young singer doing Haydn and Handel. And we will kick off that program with the Candide Overture. There's another Bernstein event called, Ver Bernstein Remix. And there's an Liz Thompson and Cliff Pearson, the founders of the festival, assembled an amazing group of people. It's too long to mention, but that will be hosted by Jamie Bernstein, the oldest daughter.
Okay.
And Sharon Isbin is on that program.
Oh, I bet that'll be wonderful.
Yeah,
She's
that could have, yeah.
so good.
It's going to be amazing. Then we have a gamelan program, and we have the same day following the gamelan. So there'll be a program featuring Damien Sneed, who's just an amazing American composer, who writes in a kind of gospel style, but gospels that can go thoroughly in the direction of jazz, go thoroughly in the direction of contemporary classical music. He's
Cool.
very versatile, and he's an improviser. His program is about called Habitat East, and it celebrates Jimmy Carter, whose first project with Habitat for Humanity was at Tompkins Square Park. And the concert will take place at St. Mark's in the Bowery, just a few blocks away from Tompkins Square Park. And that village connection between Jimmy Carter and Greenwich and East Village gives us an excuse to explore the music that Jimmy Carter brought to the White House, which was quite broad. And some people think that, the gospel music and jazz that he brought to the White House helped to legitimize and solidify the place of gospel music in American culture. And I would say Damien Sneed, he calls himself an American composer, and I started calling myself an American composer, like in exactly the same spirit that he does, because it's embracing truly homegrown American idioms, gospel. But we were in France together a couple of weeks ago for a summer symposium, a music symposium, and he gave a presentation about his music. His Langston Hughes settings, which we played for us. I played a recording of it for our composers conference. It's in a very advanced gospel jazz language that can be very powerful, and it's not without moments of really biting dissonance.
Oh.
So it's a language it's alive. It's not a dead language. It's on the move. It's on the move in the hands of Damien Sneed. And I don't know if you know who Damien Sneed is, but he was Jesse Norman's pianist for a while. And
Oh, wow.
Jesse Norman brought him to the White House.
Oh, okay.
And he tells the story of his adventure with Jesse Norman in the most amusing way, because he imitates Jesse Norman's voice. And I don't even want to try to imitate him imitating her, but she was such a. She reminds me a little bit of Marilyn Horne, in that she held herself like a queen. She was a queen.
Yes to both.
People who know me think of me as being someone who was interested in the high modernists, because I recorded so much music by people like Charles Warren and Milton Babbitt and Mario Davidovsky. By being actively involved with that music, I learned to really love it and understand it in a way that maybe one cannot if you're only listening from the audience. I don't really believe that. I think if you listen enough, you can understand it as well as I can.
Do you have difficulty relating to your audiences or even getting an audience? I mean, some of this can be kind of harsh to the untrained ear.
I pull rabbits out of hats. So I did a program for Ben Boritz and my late friend composer Frank Brickell last December, and some of my friends came just to see what it was all about, and they said, "Bill, you did it again. You got an audience." I get decent audiences, and sometimes I get very good audiences, and I don't know how I do it. So, I can tell you when I started out, people like Milton Babbitt and his colleague Jacques Monod, he had this group called the New York Guild of Composers, and they would have concerts where there was like some miserable handful of people in the audience. And yes, yeah, so that used to be the old way. Now, this is an interesting question, and I'm glad you mentioned this, because how do you change? How does you let your inner core open up and enlarge out of what you hold tightly to you? And this is what I've been doing. At first, I called it infiltration, but after a while, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like you're down in the trenches, getting dirty together, working toward making some kind of music happen. So, I think that's my work with Village Trip was an infiltration of the folk scene, because it was a more of a f centered on the village folk scene. And now I'm at first, if I thought of it as an infiltration, I no longer do. I feel like we're working together, and I try to intersect. Like James Martin, the baritone, he has a Joni Mitchell piece on his program.
Oh.
Yeah, and also I would say that we have string quartet Ethel doing some new pieces for electric guitar and string quartet, and they intersect with the Bang on a Can
Yeah.
composer. So everyone knows what the Bang on the Can scene is about, right? Or
Right.
should I say something about it? But Bang on the Can and Babbitt were at odds. They're polar opposites. Bang on the Can is about banging on cans, and Babbitt is about something else. And so what they used to talk about uptown and downtown. Babbitt is uptown. Bang on the Can was downtown.
Okay.
So by getting dirty together and working together in the trenches, I think we start to open up and broaden our outlook and our purview. Our musical tastes can grow and enlarge if you know how to do it. But I respect people who know what they like and know what they don't like. But because I'm now involved with the Roger Shapiro Fund for New Music, presenting things, I'm very aware that I want this to be bigger than merely my tastes. That's very important. So that's why I find partners who like Ethel, the Bang on the Pan people, together with Philip Glass and his circle, including Nico Muhly, the young minimalist, they created an audience for contemporary music, and my hat is off to them. I respect them for doing that. And now the music that I was doing when I was younger were these modernists that I mentioned, who are all dead now. They were not completely failing at getting people interested in the music. It was more difficult. It wasn't as easy. It wasn't trying to be easy. And really, this is a big conversation. But I talk about the John Rockwell coup. And David Amram also has another perspective. There, I have two perspectives other than my own about the John Rockwell coup. David Amram tells a story, and Leon Fleischer tells a story. And I worked a lot with Leon Fleischer. He was one of the directors of the Theater Chamber Players, together with Gina Kostin. And Gina Kostin was the founder of the Roger Shapiro Fund. So I'd like to mention her, because Gina Kostin was a wonderful composer, and I was a big champion of her music. And that brought me to Leon Fleischer, who helped me promote Gina Kostin's music. So where was I? Basically,
Well, we were talking about the revolution,
all right, yeah, the Rockwell Revolution. That's so important. I was coming around to the Rockwell Revolution, and I wanted to bring in Leon Fleisher because he tells a really great story about it. Let me first outline what this revolution is and what I mean by it. David Amram says that John Rockwell went up to Paul Fromm of the Fromm Festival at Tanglewood, was a contemporary music festival, and they decided that they would. I might butcher this story, but this is what I remember from David Amram's telling. They went to Gunther Schuller and says, "We want an all Philip Glass concert." And Gunther Schuller says, "I'm not at all. I'm completely supportive of programming Philip Glass, but we never do all Philip Glass. We never do all only one composer. We always mix it up." So they fired him. And then Leon Fleisher got fired. And the story that he tells about he was part of the same coup. It was an artistic coup. Seiji had something to do with his firing, and he went to Seiji Ozawa and said, "What was missing? Tell me what was missing." And Seiji Ozawa said, "Tabasco sauce." Yeah, now he was just being cute. Really, what was missing is what was going on with the Rockwell coup is that the modernists, including the ones that I love, and whose music I embrace wholeheartedly, I think the modernists started suffering from mission creep,
Oh.
and so, as David Amram says, he felt at a certain point it started to become like a competition for who can create the most obtuse and off-putting musical surfaces, you know. And I totally get that because so the thing is, the thing about those weird musical surfaces that when someone who knows what they're doing is making something weird, they're doing it because of certain processes and dynamic processes that are going on. But those processes and the ideals behind them got lost. And so it became a fashion. People thought that their job was to just make some crazy surface. And bizarre gestures. And I call that modernist mission creep. And I've come to realize that John Rockwell and those people who really helped tamp down those modernists, you know, I was resentful of them at the time, but now after 20 years of thinking about it, I see they overcompensated. But I understand why they did it. And I think that those modernists that suffered because the spotlight was taken off of them and put elsewhere, namely on Philip Glass. It helped them because it's a form of benign neglect. So they'll go on and keep doing what they're doing. No one's stopping them. And meanwhile, the bar has been set higher because they have to be effective. They have to speak. They have to communicate.
Right.
I never was one to think that if the modernists adhere to high and lofty compositional principles, those principles should not be yoked to a specific sound, a specific surface. They're two different things. I think that those great modernist principles can be made to sound like anything, and that's what I try to do in my music. So
Well, you use electric guitar. For some of the things that you've done, and but I have a quick question I want to stick in here if I can, as a guitarist, the guitar is a uniquely difficult instrument to compose for. So have you run into issues with composers who just absolutely are in the deep end and over their head?
Yes. So the smarter composers, they would just decide that they would only write a single line and or maybe the occasional double stop. Now,
Okay.
double stop is more of a violin term. It's
Yeah, just two notes at a time, right?
the guitars can actually do chords. The guitar is an amazing instrument, but it's very particular. It's very Baroque in that sense, because in the Baroque period, people liked instruments with very bizarre features like fiorbos in reentrant tuning. Yeah, people have trouble with guitar. And so my teacher, David Starobin, he was proud of building a repertoire of music, new music for guitar. And, he got Elliot Carter to write changes and Shard for solo guitar. And I did that too. So I was going around getting people to write for guitar, helping them know how to do it. And then one of my students wrote a little manual. His name's Jason Sagabiel, and I've been distributing that. It's pretty well done. He wants to work on it some more. But I have worked on quantifying certain things about writing for guitar, what to do, and some limitations to think about. The best way to write for guitar is to know it and know what the fingers are doing.
Of course.
So I'm a composer, and because I play mandolin, I can think in the mandolin tuning. I can think in fifths. I can see a violin part and know exactly how it's fingered because
Right.
my mandolin playing, my reading on the mandolin got actually really good over the years. And then same with tenor banjo, because tenor banjo is tuned like a viola.
Oh, okay.
So, and a viola is a cello an octave higher. So composers have to learn the strings. They
You
should really
know,
learn the guitar.
I taught most of my career in the East Lansing area with Michigan State University right in the backyard, and I would regularly get phone calls from graduate students in the composition department there who would say, "Well, I've written this piece and it has a guitar in it. Could you play it for me?" And the first question I ask is, "Is it going to obligate me to pound on the top of my guitar and scritch up and down the strings?" And there would be this long, uncomfortable silence. And go, "Yeah, nope, sorry, not interested." Because they didn't know what else to do with the instrument. They might throw in a note here and a note there, and they of course they had fallen victim to the old trope that guitar players can't read music. So that was their contribution, was they would turn it into some sort of peculiar percussion instrument. Okay. No, I'm sorry. And again, it came back to that idea that nobody on faculty up there knew how to write for the guitar, and so they didn't know how to incorporate it in the music that they were writing.
Right. Well, I'm glad you said that. I can bounce something back to you. I've been working. I've been into trenches, infiltrating in Europe. I've been infiltrating the spe some spectral scenes and some microtonal scenes. There is a problem now, especially in Europe. Easy ways to be innovative, and so I'm more interested in integration. I will accept any innovation, but I will immediately try to integrate it into all the unquantifiable compositional tricks and practices that are out there gathering for centuries and centuries and centuries. I don't like to see musical modalities drop off because people's focus becomes on playing the instrument in a funny way, doing all these extended
Right.
techniques and whatnot. The extended techniques are, I can embrace them
Oh, yeah.
as long as the composer doesn't forget how to compose, doesn't think that these extended techniques are a substitute for learning how to compose. Mario Davidovsky, if we could talk about him for a second, when he was younger, he was a bit of a rebel and a maverick. And his electronic music, his synchronisms, th those were a bit of a thumbing the nose at the establishment. And I respect that. But later in his life, he was just listening to Beethoven quartets every night, and his music became extremely alluring and beautiful and imaginative. And basically, over the lifetime, he mellowed and he became a composer focused on instrumentalists and listeners. And he made music that communicates. And I made this point at the Library of Congress when we played his Ladino songs, because my ensemble Cygnus was in residence there. And I spoke up before we began the performance. I said, "I consider this bourgeois music." So sometimes these rebels who are doing weird things and trying to be new and trying to be innovative and try to be revolutionary, sometimes they outgrow that. They don't have to discard any of their early experiments, but they integrate them. They absorb the tradition. It's unquantifiable. The tradition is too vast. You can't parse it. But they
Right.
gradually work into it and integrate And that's what interests me. I'm not interested in facile revolutions, facile reinventions of the but you know, words are dangerous. I came back in the early O's. My ensemble Cygnus was in residence at Sarah Lawrence, and a member of Speculum Musicae, the oboe, the clarinet player. He came to our performance of the student compositions, and he mentions that some of the young people are reinventing the wheel. And I listened to him. You know, I'm very influent. I'm easy to influence me because the words get into my head and they jangle around. And I thought, yeah, he's reinventing the wheel. He said it like it's a bad thing. So it took me a couple years of thinking about that, but I realized that the young people always reinvent the wheel, don't they?
Yep.
Let them reinvent the wheel, because it won't be, it'll be a wheel with different stripes. It'll be a special wheel. It might, you know. So
Well, they do in popular music all the time, and we take it for granted. But as soon as we step outside of that, all of a sudden it's like, well, they're being disrespectful or something, you know. It's classical music, or it's jazz, or it's folk, or how dare you, you know? And I mean, and in rock and roll, I mean, they just, and popular, and not just rock and roll, popular music. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure that Frank Sinatra was considered kind of a rabble rouser in his day, you know, just, and the big band stuff that we, you know, that our grandparents listened to and our parents listened to, was that was innovative in its day, you know, the idea of going to a concert of Benny Goodman as opposed to dancing to the music. It was just a dance band after all. Yeah.
good
So
point. Yeah.
you have all of that history, but we sort of take it for granted, you know. And you know, we the 60s begat the 70s begat the 80s, on and on and on, in popular music. And we forget that classical music is the same way. But I'm sure, you know, that, I mean, you know, people in Mozart's day thought of J.S. Bach as being old-fashioned and not worthy.
Well, actually, thanks for that. That gives me an excuse to mention something. Classical music in the United States has always been the classical composers and the classical performers were often empathizing with dynamics that are in play in Europe. So let me talk for a moment about Bauhaus, because on this festival we're doing a program with the guitarists. It's I think we're going to have it on the 12th, September 12th at Loft 393, featuring Stefan Volpa, who was a he lived at Westbeth. He was a Greenwich Village composer, but he was originally from the Bauhaus scene, like Joseph Albers, the color theorist who ended up
Okay.
at Dachau. Joseph Albers and Stefan Volpa are both Bauhaus figures. Both and the Bauhaus was responding. The Bauhaus was part of a dynamic. Young artists were nauseated by imperial pomp in the architecture and in the music, and in ornamentation that smacked of the upholding of a system that was no longer serving the people, but was concerned only with serving itself. Now, in the United States, we never really had that problem because, unlike France, our democracy functioned pretty well for a while. No, but it always had ups and downs and bumps and. But nevertheless, our artists, if there's an artist who was like influenced by the Bauhaus, the elements that created the Bauhaus, they weren't really at play here. And until now. Until now. So now we're getting into a situation where some of those some pushback against architecture that props up a value structure that's not really serving the people. That's what Bauhaus is all about. So, I don't want to say too much about it because it's dangerous, but Stefan Volpa lived in Westbeth, which was this interesting building. David Del Tredici also lived there. And he was an important teacher. And one of his students was Leo Brouwer, one of the most loved and widely performed guitarist composers, not inaccessible at all. So there's an example of a dynamism where in Europe you have artistic movements that towards streamlining, toward getting away from ornamentation that became a bad habit and became an emblem of a corrupt regimes, such as, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was a police state. And many moments in 19th century France, it was a police state. And the architecture that propped up those states, people started to develop a great dislike for it. And I find myself, I was just in Europe for the first 6 weeks. I was doing a lecture tour talking about composition in Salzburg, Berlin, Dublin, and then France. And I was looking at architecture. Whenever I see the Jugendstil, which is the equivalent of Art Nouveau in France,
Okay.
I love it so much. And Americans don't necessarily know why they love it, but in Europe, there's a dynamism behind it. It was a pushback against empty values.
Oh.
Yes, absolutely. People don't know that. People don't realize it. It's very important. So I think about Louis Comfort Tiffany, who was influenced by the French Art Nouveau, but I don't think that there was that edge to it, that combative aspect, because his clients were all rich robber barons.
So, you know what? We are just about out of time, sir, and I could just go on forever and ever and ever. But
Well,
the big thing, let's cover, if we can, real quick, like again, the dates on the village trip, if we may, please, and what to expect there.
I thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Village Trip. At the events, there's a pre-festival weekend of it's a guitar festival, September 12, 13, 14. The festival starts on the 19th with baritone James Martin and Lynn Raley, pianist, and others. And it continues for through the 28th. And I recommend, please remember thevillagetrip.com. It's very easy.
Oh yeah, okay.
Thevillagetrip.com.
There'll be a link in the description below.
And there's so many important premieres, Thomas Flippin, David Amram. Let me see. I tried to write them down. Luke Harchin, Sam Adler. They're composers. The great thing about the Village Trip is that I'll have some modernists, but I'll also have some bang on the can people. And it could be that I'm the only one, the Roger Shapiro Fund, that is the only organization that really gathers together composers who otherwise would be fighting each other and whacking each other over the heads. So I'm proud of that. And I'm proud of my it's difficult, but I have learned how to undo my own ideological fixations and open myself up somewhat. It's hard, but I do it. I do my best.
So what are
And
you doing this weekend? There's a little dust up in Israel right now. Maybe you can fix that too.
all I can say is that if people know how people are amphibious, they're of different worlds. The brain and the heart are so. If people can learn how to negotiate between those two different worlds, then they won't need some authority to tell them what's up and what's down. And that's what the arts are about.
Right, exactly. So, Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show. I so deeply appreciate it. And I want to have you back on soon so we can just keep jabbering about this stuff. I'm just really I feel like I'm a hog rolling in it, as we say in the
It's been a great pleasure, Roger. Thanks for letting me go on and on. And if there's anything that gets boring, you just chop it out, okay?
Midwest. I can do that. Thanks, Bill. I'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, thanks. Great pleasure. Take care.
A big thanks to William Anderson for taking the time from his very busy day to talk with me. And thank you too for spending time with us. If you would like to keep up with the future adventures of Bill or any of my guests, just subscribe to my website. That's www.rogerhumphrey.com for my weekly blog. It's usually pretty short and even has some pretty pictures. I promise, no spam. And in the meantime, check out some of my other episodes of Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.